right, everyone. It's Thursday, February 6th. I woke up this morning, everyone. You listen to The Attitude with Artie Artisan and Ken Barnes, weather report, of course. I woke up this morning and I went, snow. There's snow on the ground. We haven't seen snow in a long time, everyone. In fact, at some point in time, it was like 40 degrees, I think, even this week. And I was just so shocked that I went, just in time for the New Hampshire primary. I mean, we have to fill out that image of who we are. And if people are walking around with, like, you know, light shirts and sweaters and not wearing, like, overcoats and boots, it would not be the New Hampshire primary. So we had snow last night. We're supposed to have snow, I think, tomorrow. So we will fill the image of New Hampshire, I'm sure, for Tuesday. Yeah. And as we're still continuing to follow the chaos, Kim and Ed of Iowa, I do recommend everyone that you listen to the show on Friday. We interviewed Sean Sebastian, who is an on-the-ground organizer in Iowa. Gave us really, really interesting content and information. It's a little bit sketchy because he's on his cell phone, but you can't knock him for what he shares with us. So I really recommend it, and I think it's important. And part of the reasons why, you know, we both ended up suggesting at the end of the interview, which everyone's going to hate me for, especially in New Hampshire and maybe even in Iowa, but I think Iowa's come to Jesus on this, is that we probably should not be having the First in the Nation caucus or primary anymore, that we don't really represent the demographics of the country, that we really need to begin to look around and share the wealth and share the information and share the engagement, frankly. And I did mention this with Sean, and I'm going to mention this with you. It was my tweet of the day, which I think is one thing that's a compliment to Iowa. In the last three Democratic primaries, the top vote getters in Iowa were a black man, a woman, a socialist Jew, a gay man. If that's not historic, I don't know what is. So you better talk. I got to get some water. But anyway.
That is a pretty impressive statistic. And I would also suggest, by the way, that if you are trying to sort out the chaos of what happened in Iowa, in addition to listening to tomorrow's show, today we have Stefan Schmidt, Dr. Politics from Iowa State University, known television commentator and everything else during the Iowa primaries for, I don't know, 100 years or so. And he's on our show talking about Iowa. I happen to disagree with Arnie about the New Hampshire primary. I won't comment on the Iowa caucuses having a right to be first, but there is really a lot to be said for some kind of retail politics coming first.
Oh, no, I don't disagree with you. There are other small states. Can I disabuse you of this? Not just New Hampshire is a small state with a small population. 38 states have populations under the size of New York City. So when you realize that we're small, and I agree with you, I love it. I think there's value to it. Does it still make sense that we are it?
I'm not saying this because I love it, although I absolutely do. But I don't know about the other cities that are under the size of New York. New York has
states under
the size of New York, because that's 8 million people. We have about 1 million people, which is pretty small. And I think that the kicking the tires that is done by New Hampshire voters in people's living rooms,
I don't disagree.
You really get not just a kind of intimacy and chance to follow up with the candidates, but also they have to really listen to you.
I totally agree with you.
The issues, and you can cut through the BS, because every candidate in any political race has a pat answer to every question. And sometimes it's just their talking points and doesn't even answer the question. But even when they answer the question, it's kind of diversionary about any real meat. And we get to follow up and ask them for some real meat.
Right.
What about this consideration? And they've got to actually.
And they don't have to have money to necessarily run here. They don't have to have name recognition to run here. I totally agree with you. Mm-hmm. The problem is we are a rich white state. Let me repeat that. A rich white state. And there are other states that have small populations that are more reflective of the demographic. I want to know what a Hispanic would say when they asked a candidate a question. I want to know what a black would say. I don't know that, because I betcha in New Hampshire and in Iowa, they were asked questions by blacks and Hispanics maybe four times in a year. And I think that is unfortunate, because it doesn't force them to actually flesh out who they are and what they believe through a lens that's different from yours and mine.
Oh, absolutely. It definitely should be a more diverse conversation. But I'll tell you something, Arnie. We view ourselves as a lily white state. But the fact of the matter is, if the candidates go to places in Manchester, New Hampshire, Nashua, New Hampshire, there is a huge, huge Latin community.
And people from
Central America, from South America.
Right.
You have a chance to find out what Latinos and Latinas think.
So let me just to say similar things. So there was a satellite caucus and I think it was like a meat packing plant or whatever, and it was basically all Ethiopians that had become American citizens. They voted for Bernie Sanders like 78%. Okay? So Bernie knew to have a conversation with them. They knew who he was. Maybe he was the only candidate that went to the Ethiopians and said, you know, who are American citizens today, and said, let's talk about your lives. Mm-hmm. And as a result, they voted overwhelmingly, and they may make it so he does beat Pete, because when that district, that little satellite caucus comes in, those relationships and those numbers and those conversations are important. That's even – there's greater potential for diversity in Iowa, sadly, than there is maybe in New Hampshire. I know you're right about Nashua, and I know you're right about Manchester. I am just saying that as much as I covet what we have, the way we want to ask, is the status quo still make sense for the politics we do? Aren't we part of the status quo?
Well, I think that a bigger problem, frankly, is the disparity between the Democratic Party in every state and in the country, the way it controls the debates, the elections, the primaries, who gets covered, the corporate media in terms of fair coverage of and in giving a full voice to candidates like Bernie, who they don't even mention in
except
a lot
with
of
disgust.
Places.
Except
with disgust, like, oh, my God, we can't allow this.
Oh, that's right. That's right. We're all going to become – we're all going to become – actually, here's the good news. We're not going to be like Donald Trump's Putin.
Yeah.
Okay? We're gonna be more like, you know, the Scandinavians as well.
But what I'm saying is I think that's a more important thing for everybody in the country to be talking about to change our electoral process than just talking about whether it should be Iowa, New Hampshire versus some other small state.
Well, speaking about bad coverage, everyone's talking about Michael Bloomberg, but they're talking about how much money he's spending. What they're not talking about with Michael Bloomberg is exactly who he is, what does he represent, what has he done, what does it mean that he can acquire this next presidential campaign. And that's why we're going to grab Bob Hennelly, because Bob Hennelly knows better than anyone what this is, and he writes eloquently about it, and we're so grateful.
Right, let me just say that it's pretty pathetic that we're talking about Bloomberg's mega money as if it's a good thing. You know,
that's
he's not taking donors from Wall Street, but he owns Wall Street.
And that's exactly what Bob is going to talk about, because he talks about sort of, you know, what Michael Bloomberg represents and what are the consequences of who Michael Bloomberg is, how he made his money, how he covers things, how he sort of works and represents the financial institutions in America, and how those financial institutions have let us down, everyone. Let us down. So I just want to let you know, so I'm listening to MSNBC this morning, and I was so upset as they're waxing poetic about how this fear of a strong safety net and social policies and whatever, and they were sort of crafting this image of a Bernie Sanders who, by the way, had been the mayor of Burlington, Vermont, and it turned out that the business community found out that he cared about things that actually benefited business, but we won't go there. So this is what I did, everyone, because I was so angry. And look, there are things I don't agree with Bernie Sanders, and I'm a person who might be more willing to talk about how we segue to Medicare for all. I'm more willing to talk about how there may be a glide path to something, because I know that life is not a switch on and a switch off. But here's what I did at my Facebook page, because I was so ticked. I wrote, message to 1%. I think that's Michael Bloomberg. I think that's Jeff Bezos too. Anyway, message to 1%. We despise you. You have eaten up our paychecks, undermine our kids' future, and destroyed our planet. The status quo? No, thank you. And on that note, joining us by phone is Bob Hennelly. Bob Hennelly writes for The Chief Leader. You can follow him at Stuck Nation. He writes columns at Salon.com. And is when it comes to knowing Michael Bloomberg, he's probably our go-to source. And in part, the reason why we go to Bob Hennelly is because we get so little content coverage of Michael Bloomberg. You know, everybody's in awe of how many dollars he is spending. They're in awe of the commercials he's dropping. But you know what? There's got to be more than that kind of coverage, because he's running for president and he wants to acquire the position. Welcome to the program, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. So I was telling my audience this morning, because we tape a show for Friday, how Stefan Schmidt, our guy from Iowa, called me up last night, and Iowa just completed their caucus, Bob, right? So, and it's still in chaos, but we're sort of getting close to the end, I guess. And so he's watching television with his wife in Iowa, and all of a sudden he sees a commercial. And the commercial is for Michael Bloomberg. And the commercial has pictures of Barack Obama everywhere. All right? And remember, this is a guy who's very sophisticated, 50 years political science, known as Dr. Politics in Iowa. And, of course, if you step back, you realize, did Barack Obama endorse Michael Bloomberg on that commercial? Or was that just that they happened to be in the same room together and they were saying nice things about each other? His immediate reaction was to call me and say, oh, my God, Obama and Bloomberg are in this commercial and it's showing in Iowa. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. He said he just screwed Joe Biden. So in a lot of ways, and yet it's so ironic because it probably wasn't an endorsement, but who knows? Because when you see the images together and you know that Michael Bloomberg knows how to thread that needle so well that the commercial will create the illusion of an endorsement and he can pay for it in 50 states, he just not only completely nailed Joe Biden's coffin, but he enhanced his stature.
Yeah, well, I think during that period of time that Mayor Bloomberg was mayor, there was like 12 years there, mm-hmm. And that was during the period, of course, when President Obama was attempting, I mean, for my taste, not as radically as required, but there was an attempt, window dressing at least, to regulate Wall Street that had taken Main Street and MLK Boulevard for a magical mystery tour where everybody lost their houses.
Right.
And during that time, actually, every time that President Obama would talk about transparency, right-sizing the banks, dealing with the over-financialization, which is really what the problem is here, is the over-financialization in our lifetime.
Right, exactly.
Where banks went from, and there's people much smarter than myself that have written about this, once upon a time, banks served the economy. And then an evil thing happened with bipartisan support, which Joe Biden, as the senator from Delaware, was helpful with. They came to serve themselves. And so now, And that was really Bloomberg LP, the information systems. That was what Michael Bloomberg served, was that nervous system, if you will, that globalized great wealth. And often the mayor would be a counterpoint to President Obama's efforts to go with Elizabeth Warren-light regulation and actually hold press conferences and say things like, you know, the president is pushing in the wrong direction. We need money from Wall Street to pay the firefighters and teachers. And so, you know, he was always concerned that too much regulation would result in harnessing Wall Street's ability to, you know, make New York City number one. And the reality, though, is that, you know, there's much to recommend Michael Bloomberg. That's the thing I've tried to make clear in my writing. There is things that he's advocated at a time when no one else was, with a scale of wealth and commitment no one else has matched. And I'm speaking of climate control, public health, climate change, guns, and also invested in municipalities and saw that when the federal efforts at climate change were getting stuck, that there needed to be a global response. But the thing that he's always had an aversion to is disclosing his taxes. And so I'm 64 and I really want to see a new movie. And I'm feeling from the direction of things that we're going for Groundhog Day. 2016, you may remember, a pseudo-billionaire or a billionaire, depending on how you count it, uses his global brand name and takes over a major party and doesn't disclose his taxes. Who would that be?
Oh, yep.
Have we seen it before?
Yep, exactly. No. So Donald Trump did to the Republican Party what you're concerned about with what Mayor Bloomberg is going to do. But let's talk about these taxes. So one of the reasons why everybody wanted to see Donald Trump's taxes is, one, they thought it would prove what everyone sort of suspects, that he's not really a billionaire. It would also prove where he gets his money. It would also prove sort of these financial connections that everybody is suspicious about. What I'm trying to figure out is, I mean, we're talking on a much huger scale, $55 billion, $54 billion. And so I can't even imagine the kind of accountants we're going to need to, like, evaluate what that tax return looks like. But what are you concerned about? With Trump, it was about corruption. With Trump, it was about tentacles into other countries. With Trump, it was about all kinds of things, I think, that would have told a story that is pretty sordid and pretty dark. I think we almost feel, and maybe I'm wrong here, that what we know about Bloomberg is that what he did was amass an incredible fortune. He probably did it in a way that was very legal. The problem is what we've made legal probably should have been illegal because we've, you know, unleashed blanks. We've allowed them to take risks that you and I can't take, but we cover their ass. So what I'm trying to figure out right now is what do we do? What's your argument for this when we couldn't make the argument for Trump?
Well, one is the fact that when I started covering the mayor, he had an arrangement with the Conflict of Interest Board, which is a body that regulates public employment and the interface between the private sector and public service here. And it has a fine tradition. And so he had to disclose every year the entities that he had material control over.
Okay.
So when he first came in, it was 40 entities around the world. By the time I had a look at it, it was up to 80. And so these are, you know, and I've reprised this reporting in Salon, and these include things like Cayman Island LLC, Bermuda, his philanthropy, nonprofit philanthropy and foundation. There's been some reporting on that. If people go to the trouble, they can find it, where investments were posted in places like Mauritius and the Cayman Islands, well-known.
For tax evasion, right, exactly.
Right. Well, tax evasion and tax avoidance are very different. One can make a fortune, the other can get you 10 and Leavenworth. So we have to be very careful with the terms we use here.
Tax avoidance.
The question here is that we have a global system of taxation where, in the post-World War II environment, nations have been outdoing each other, a race to the bottom, if you will, to try to attract capital. And so they'll do things like, well, you don't have to disclose beneficial ownership. You can have a minimum. The movie Laundromat, which was a Sundance parody, got at a lot of this. And so this is part of the financialization of the planet. So you have people able to amass vast fortunes that are beyond the scrutiny and reach of any particular government. Now, they can disclose properly where they're from. They can pay the taxes that are due. But the reality is we're at a weird place in human history. Consider that human beings are constrained by borders. In fact, we're seeing one of the greatest refugee crises in the post-World War II environment, where people are literally being put in cages and dying because they can't negotiate a border. Meanwhile, wealth on the scale of Michael Bloomberg
has no
travels
borders.
Around the world
exactly.
with no inhibition whatsoever.
Brilliant.
And so it's no accident that we find ourselves at a point where wealth disparity has been never greater, and transparency and accountability are in scarce supply. I submit that Michael Bloomberg fixes this with one news cycle by proving that he really is a different billionaire with a white hat by simply disclosing his taxes, and that's the end of it.
So as I'm listening to this, the other thing that concerns me, though, is the media coverage of Michael Bloomberg. And Michael Bloomberg still controls Bloomberg News. And one of the first things I thought he should do if he's running for office is to release his control of Bloomberg News, because he's already put some kind of constraints on them, which I'm not sure what that means. And then you begin to wonder whether the stories that you're seeing coming out of Bloomberg News are really stories that are arm's length and generic the way he claims he wants them to be, or whether they're actually being fed stories that sort of aid and abet the continuation of his acquisition of the presidency. And that part of it's part of the problem, because I'm going to Bloomberg News going, wow, this benefits Michael. Wow, this benefits Michael. And yet that's another part of the problem. We already know what's happening to journalism in this country. We already know about media consolidation in this country. We all know about, you know, who gives us, who provides us with access to information. So not only is he not getting coverage from whatever's left of the media, but this important media source, which actually its area of expertise is where he is incredibly successful, called money, is controlled by him.
Well, one of the things to keep in mind here is that there has been, and I've done reporting on this, others have too, there was an internal memo from the director of editorial operations, which laid out the framework internally, which was released, I guess, by must have been some partisan member of the resistance within the Bloomberg LP empire. But it described how they were not going to do any in-depth coverage targeting his opponents, nor Michael, but do the kind of coverage they did when he was mayor. And evidently everyone on the email must have known what that meant. So it's kind of like a stand down mode in terms of what they're doing. Now, I would say it's a little bit more problematic, because what you'll notice is that the coverage that we're seeing on MSNBC and the other corporate news media is driven by the TikTok that they know well, which is Iowa. We reserve our rooms there. We go to New Hampshire. But in reality, Michael Bloomberg and Donald Trump have already blown up the primary process,
exactly,
which the media is very wedded to as a bedtime story. It's already somewhat, they're doing all they can to make it irrelevant, and they did that with the $10 million ad for the Super Bowl.
Right.
And so Michael Bloomberg is already having a national campaign. Mm-hmm. He's already lining up endorsements from the mayor of Shreveport, Adrian Perkins, the mayor of D.C., Muriel Bowser.
Yeah.
There will be 1,200 events this weekend. And so this is being done in a way that he's advancing his cause, building up his numbers, and floating the corporations that bring us the media with unprecedented amounts of money, hundreds of millions
exactly
of dollars,
exactly,
which are such a scale and so singular,
right,
that they'll start showing up in SEC documents as a major windfall. It'll have to be declared to the markets because it's such a gargantuan event. In that, in essence, they're going to be funding journalism for a number of years to come. Now, the challenge for the media is, can they at least look to see what kind of manicure the hand that feeds them have, or ask them about their pinky ring?
Yeah,
I mean, that's where we are now.
No. And so as I'm listening to you, so I listen to his ads, and his ads sort of have this sort of generic Democratic feel to them. So he has this ad about, you know, you'll be able to go to a doctor, or you'll be able to get your medicine. I don't know what that means.
Right.
Or they'll talk about the fact that there's a wealth tax. So here's the question I have, because it goes back directly to what you said about the fact that he hasn't released his tax returns. And
right,
I'm going to say, so what is your wealth tax? And I want to know from your tax returns what you would pay. Because you're
right,
talking
well,
about
also,
a wealth tax, and
right,
I can't evaluate it
that's
until
a very
I know.
Good point.
And that's what you should write about at Salon. So you have a wealth tax. So the only way I know whether this is really a consequence that you will feel as well as everybody else is show me your tax returns so I can calculate what kind of bite out of your tax returns this would take, because I know what it'll take out of mine. I have no freaking clue what it'll take out of your $55
billion. I'm here to tell you, Arnie, that when we raise a problem, we try to have a solution. So I will send you, and I've given you the sound files.
Back
in 2012, this was an issue because Michael Bloomberg at one point was advising that everyone needed to pay more taxes to get a sense of societal cohesion. And so since he weighed into that area advocating for this kind of approach, that's how I got into this question about why he didn't disclose his taxes.
Right.
And so I had asked those questions. He is on tape back then. And the thing that's problematic about this is that at the time, for that whole 12 years, he used the excuse that to disclose what he paid in taxes would put him at a unfair competitive disadvantage with other people doing the same kind of business he was doing.
What?
So
what does that mean? What does that mean?
Time,
what does that mean? What does it translate
that? He put above the need for transparency and openness. When he was mayor of New York, he subjugated that to his business interest. And this press establishment in New York City let it go.
Oh.
There are a handful of people that push back, but for the most part, nobody pushed back.
This is, I mean, now I understand the tax returns. Now I understand in a way that is just, I mean, I kind of wanted it anyway, but now I feel like we're getting to flesh it out. Before I let you go really quickly, Bob, I just want to remind my audience, not only did he sort of become a Republican in order to win his seat as mayor, not only did he dump more money in order to acquire that seat, can you remind my audience, so there used to be term limits on the mayor in New York. How did he manage while he was mayor?
No, you got it wrong. It was term limits for mortals.
Oh, for mortals.
For regular people, there were term limits. And then on the horizon, Michael Bloomberg came and spent so much money, it was changed. One last thing I must tell people. The thing that concerns me is that he has applied to get an extension for even filing the Federal Election Commission basic disclosures until after Super Tuesday. So here's an irony for you.
Wow.
Mr. Donald Trump filed his in 2016. So I just hope that, you know, the folks here at Bloomberg put that together and just put it out there so we can move on to the substance.
Well, I'm going to remind everyone, I said this to the Washington Post reporter that hung out with me yesterday. I said, you know, in New Hampshire, you know, we know who's on the ballot. We know that 40% of the electorate are undeclared, so they can pick up a Republican ballot or a Democratic ballot. I said, what is going to be really interesting to me, because Michael Bloomberg's conversation, he's dominating the news, even though they're not investigating him. They're just complimenting him on all the money he's spending. Right. And they're constantly connecting the Joe Biden failure to that. It creates opportunity for Michael Bloomberg. So what I said to her was, I said, start watching to see how many write-ins there are for Michael Bloomberg on Tuesday's New Hampshire primary. Look at the Republican side of the aisle and look at the Democratic side of the aisle. Because although he's technically not running, he is running because his ads are running in Massachusetts. They're running in Vermont. They're actually running on MSNBC and CNN. They're not called ads. They're called content. And as a result, I think it's going to be really interesting because that also is going to be a message. So the question is not only where is Joe Biden's sort of support not, going to go to? Is it going to go to a Mayor Pete, or is it going to go to a pencil that says Bloomberg?
It's going to say we have to save capitalism, and Michael Bloomberg's unorthodox candidacy is the firewall.
You got it. You got it. Thank you, Bob Henley. We're going to call you very often. All right, take care.
Bye.
Thank you so much. Bob Henley writes for the Chief Leader. He also is at Stuck Nation, or go to Salon.com. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. A little labor history is next.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1919. That day began the week-long general strike in Seattle, Washington. As World War I drew to a close, many workers in the city were frustrated by 2 years without pay increases due to the war. 35,000 workers in the shipyards walked off the job. Workers from most of the 110 union locals across the city voted to support the general strike. At 10 a.m. on February 6th, the citywide strike began. As many as 65,000 workers, or a fifth of the entire workforce of the city, walked off the job. They were met by a combined force of the police and the military. It has been nearly a century since the Seattle General Strike. This unprecedented stand by the city's workers has been remembered and commemorated in many ways. Perhaps the most innovative memorial came in the form of a rock opera. In 1985, Rob Rosenthal set the story of the strike to music. He based the lyrics on research and interviews he did as a graduate student at UC Santa Barbara over the course of 10 years. A band named The Fuse formed to record the 21-song album. The final project was a blend of rock, blues, and folk. The music tells the story of a fictional man who comes to Seattle looking for work in the shipyards during World War I, joining the labor movement and the strike. What labor history event would you like to hear set to music?
Without a muscle, without a brain, nothing would ever go. We run it all. We run it all.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Andrew Bryan is a clinical social worker in Seattle. He says recently, global warming has started coming up more and more in his therapy sessions with clients. So to connect people to helpful resources, he started a website called Climate and Mind. Since then,
people have been contacting me from Seattle and also from different parts of the world looking for help or resources because they're struggling with specifically climate anxiety and depression and trauma.
He encourages people to acknowledge and reflect on their emotions about global warming.
Just noticing in themselves and their bodies, in their ideas and thoughts, how are they experiencing the impacts of climate change and the idea of what the future is going to hold.
Then he says it helps to talk about those feelings and connect with others who share the same concerns. People may then be ready to act, whether that's reducing their own carbon pollution or taking political action.
We can take an action that's right for us and that helps us feel empowered and engaged with the world and not helpless.
So he says confronting one's feelings about global warming can help people feel better and become more powerful agents of change. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Election friends, that's no small order. Just blow notes, sweep all the votes from Canada to the Mexican border. I started out with a bang, blow the Dixie line. Opened and shot was burning hot, and every single vote was mine. From there I swung westward, taking every state in my stride. My bandwagon swinging, everybody started in to ride. I won every town and state without exception. My friend, I swung the election.
Oh, my God. What a fabulous song. What a fabulous song. This is the Attitude with Artie Artis, and producer Ken Barnes picks our music. Who sang I Swung the Election? Oh, my that's, God. That's going to be my theme song. I love
that's
it.
That's an old Jack Teagarden.
Oh, what a great
from
song.
Like the 30s.
Well, this is so perfect because our next guest, well, I don't know if the election was swung. I don't know. Has it been resolved yet? Joining us right now from the great state of Iowa is Stefan Schmidt, affectionately known as Dr. Politics, a professor of political science at Iowa State. Oh, my God, Stefan. Have they figured it out? Are we up to 100% yet? Or are we still at 97% with the turnout? And do we know what happened in the satellite caucuses? Because I heard that they are going to make the difference between who could actually claim in reality victory as opposed to what happened when they left Iowa. And we heard from Mayor Pete, we go on victorious. Oh, my God. Welcome to the program.
The most embarrassing state in the United States.
Yeah.
A state that can't even count, you know, the 10% of people eligible to go to caucuses who went. And the turnout was not very high.
Exactly.
And I said years ago when they started messing with the original caucuses and added stuff and started talking about, you know, how to bring other people in, that they were making a mistake because complexity usually leads to confusion and then
very
to doubt,
yeah.
And then it leads to conspiracy theories. And so the answer to your questions is it none of it matters, because I just talked to the editor of the Des Moines Register, and we're talking about now discovering that a lot of calculations that were made inside precincts were wrong. And so regardless of what they're counting down at the rundown homeless shelter called the Democratic Party headquarters doesn't matter, because apparently there's still other errors that are popping up from the precincts.
Oh my
and
God.
Arnie, let me tell you that first place, this whole hysteria of the news media, I heard it on NPR this morning. Who's going to come in first place? Oh, you know, it's a few votes between Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders. The Iowa caucuses are a media event. There is nothing to be gained from being first, second, or third. It's just a fantasy. And the media is so stupid, they don't understand that.
Yeah. Mm. No, it's I was telling my audience, I had Sean Sebastian on with me this morning because we taped the show for Friday. And both of us were so discouraged and so disgusted. And you know what he said, which is so sad. Listen to this. Sean said to me, because Sean was a precinct captain. He was a big organizer in Iowa. He's been doing this for years. He said, in a sad way, Arnie, this was the best run caucus until we had to report the numbers. He said they were organized. People knew how to do things. It was like, well, he goes, as soon as we were required to go from point A back to the Iowa Democratic Party, everything hit the fan. And it was like, and he said, and it's just, in a way, it broke his heart. But he also said at the end, we should not be having this anymore. We should not be having this anymore. And that, I think, is problematic. He said, we don't represent the country. This is out of date with what's happening. You're talking about the new technology and the changes that they made to the caucus in order to accommodate this. And with complexity comes confusion. And it's just, and in a way, for it to happen right as we're talking about impeachment, right as we're talking about the State of the Union, right as we have the most impaired president ever who is going to take this and everything else and run it up and down the flagpole because he will use it to his benefit and it will only add to our liability.
Well, we all have different opinions, right? I disagreed that these were the best run caucuses ever, blah, okay. blah, 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 blah. I did analysis for ABC, Channel 5, WOI all night long until midnight, until the satellite went down because yeah. they had only rented satellite until midnight.
Right.
And we had reports from all kinds of precincts where the local precinct people really had no idea what they were doing.
Yeah.
And I heard on our local station here in Ames an interview with a satellite caucus guy up in Minneapolis who was supposed to run that satellite.
Right.
And they asked him, they said, you know, well, what about this and that? He had no idea about the rules. He had no idea. And he was going to run the satellite caucus in Minneapolis. So, you know, the whole thing is a horribly complex process that, just, you know, get it down to the way the Republicans had no problem, Arnie. They voted, they counted the votes, they called them into the Republican headquarters, and by 9:30 at night, all the results were in. Yes, of course, there was only one candidate, but it's such a nice, clean, simple process. And the Democrats, in trying to be such a wonderful party that takes into account every single possible thing, has created something that in the end is really not very fair at all. So, yes, I'm afraid this is probably the last time we will have the caucuses. They were a nice thing, but the Democratic Party of Iowa ruined it, broke it, was incompetent in running it, and has had some problems before. Bernie Sanders is responsible for this year's collapse because he's the one who raised hell when Hillary Clinton and he were running. And he said, you know, you got to count other things. You can't just count the end at the delegate equivalency and so on. And Bernie Sanders bludgeoned the Iowa Democratic Party into creating this monstrous thing that they launched this year. And so, I know I'm going to get a lot of calls and hate mail from Bernie bros, but I'm telling you, if you go back and look at it, the reason the party started kvetching and wringing its hands and creating this giant commission to reform it was because Bernie Sanders said that in 2016 he should have won.
So
Bernie Sanders should never be in any Democratic Party events, including your primaries in New Hampshire, because Bernie Sanders is not a Democrat. I don't care how many young people he mobilizes and gets excited. Get him excited for the Socialist Party.
Stefan.
No, get him excited for the Socialist Party
the
presidency.
Wait, I'm going to stop you here. So what's Mayor Bloomberg? What's Mayor Bloomberg, sweetheart? I know he has $55 billion, so we don't ask the question.
He shouldn't be running as a Democrat either.
Exactly.
He's been all over.
But nobody's going to say that.
He's been a Democrat.
And nobody's going to say that. This is the killer. The killer
I just said it.
I don't know, but let me say something. You've known, and I'm going to get yelled at too. I didn't want Biden or Bernie to run. I didn't want Biden because I think all it's done is suck us back to the past. It hasn't allowed us to go into the future. But if we're going to call Bernie on being a Democratic Socialist, then we better call Michael Bloomberg on being a Republican. Yep. Because he was the only elected position he has ever had is as a Republican. He has never had an elected position as a Democrat. But because he's got billions, no one even brings it up. And that is part of our problem, is we are so shallow. We don't have a media that actually asks the tough questions. And everyone now, especially in the media, because Bloomberg can buy so much content with his ads, nobody will challenge him. Nobody.
It is actually the fault of the political parties who, in 1970, when there were the riots at the convention in Chicago in 1968, said, okay, we're going to create a process where anyone can run, and it's got to be democratic, and a lot of people can run and go, and we can do it with grassroots and primaries, and the party leadership shouldn't have so much power. In the past, the party leaders would never have allowed either Bloomberg or Bernie to run as a Democrat, because they were the gatekeepers. You're not a Democrat, and the Republicans should do the same. So we don't have political parties anymore. What we have is organizations that allow individuals to hijack those organizations and become president. Donald Trump is the best example.
Right.
Donald Trump should have never been allowed to run if the party bosses of the Republican Party had been in charge. And it was the Iowa caucuses that gave Donald Trump the second place out of the gate, but so-called close to Ted Cruz that it was like, wow, he did really well. Primaries and caucuses are open for this kind of malicious activity.
Yep,
let's go back to party bosses, Arnie.
Well,
I'm just kidding.
No, what you are saying to me is that the parties are non-existent. They're now independent contractors. It's independent contractors that are running. I mean, think about this. This is going to be the irony, and I posted this on Facebook, and I want to talk about it now. So we're going to have the faux despot that's Trump. That is running possibly against the real despot, because he's really a billionaire, and maybe the benevolent despot, Michael Bloomberg. But up until he ran as a Republican, Trump was a Democrat. Up until basically he decided he wanted to become mayor, Michael Bloomberg was a Republican. So we've got two candidates. The only reason why they are Republicans or Democrats is why? Tell me why. Because they could take over the party. Because they could buy the party. Because they could acquire it. Because the parties have been so hollowed out. There are no rules. There are no standards. And they're so wedded to money.
No, you're right. And what I said last night, I did Telemundo and Univision and CNN in Espanol, and they were totally freaked out when nothing came in. And so at 6 in the morning, I had 2 hours of sleep yet, caucus night. So, the truth of the matter is that we have not heard a word from the Democratic National Committee.
No.
It is a weak organization. Nobody even knows who the co-chairs are. They have had almost no role in this, apparently. And that's the truth. What you just said is true. The national parties don't matter. The state parties matter, though. I know in New Hampshire, the Democratic and Republican parties are vigorous. They raise money. They have events and so on. But they don't control who the candidates are.
Well, they don't control the definition of who a candidate is. Okay, so yeah. Ken wants to weigh in.
Can I just interject here? This is a perfect segue, because what you're saying about the parties can get hijacked, if you will, by organizations in a free election democracy, frankly, as free as our democracy is. Why don't you say the same thing about the general election? Basically, Stefan, it sounds like you're saying democracy is not working.
I think he is saying that.
Yes, exactly.
I think he is.
So why is that an issue for getting rid of primaries or not getting rid of primaries and having the parties have more control, state parties or national parties? Then what about the general election? The state primaries are basically a microcosm of the national election where money talks. And, that's what's happening here.
Stefan, I got yelled at because I wrote this piece about, my message to the 1%. And you may have heard that because you were listening to us on Skype. But then I basically said the message to the 1% is that I despise you. I said, you've eaten up my paycheck. You've undermined my children's future. You've destroyed my planet. Status quo isn't working. But you know what the story of the 1% is? The story of the 1% is Bloomberg and Trump. That's exactly what the story is. We have created this monster because we've seen this greatest gap between rich and poor. The fact that Michael Bloomberg in 2002 had a wealth of $5 billion, and in 2020, his wealth is $55 billion. I want to know whose paycheck went up even 1/22nd of what you saw going on with Michael Bloomberg. But now Michael Bloomberg can buy an election because we aided and abetted that. And then Donald Trump, by giving enormous tax cuts to corporations and to the wealthy, on top of them already being ridiculously wealthy, allowed all of them to decide, what state do I want? What country do I want? What party do I want? That's what's happening to democracy, is that the Pac-Man is money, and we have just massaged it so votes have no meaning, but checks do.
Oh, it's so interesting, Arnie, because tell me about Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Was he a pretty rich guy?
I don't disagree.
Rich guy.
John F. Kennedy.
And his father. I understand.
I've been to the Kennedy complex, the compound on Cape Cod. So tell me what's new. Where are powerful, wealthy people not able to essentially manipulate the political process?
But haven't we made it even smoother and easier?
And I'm talking to Bernie Sanders now. Bernie, are you listening to this?
Yeah.
Bernie. In Venezuela, Hugo Chavez overthrew the oligarchy, and then he became the oligarchy. And then when he died of cancer, his right-hand guy, Nicolas Maduro, who was a poor shoeshine boy or a bus driver became president and is now fabulously wealthy and has Swiss bank accounts and has caused 4 million people to flee the country because the regime has been so brutal on working class people. And yet, Bernie, you still say that Maduro is not a dictator. Has that come up in the campaign?
No.
Has Arnie ever mentioned that?
No. I know.
And when you run for president, Bernie, you're going to get nailed to the wall, and the Bernie bros are going to be shocked because they haven't been told about that, okay?
Yeah. We were talking about the fact that there's so much that has not come out. And part of the reason, let's be honest here, so they have decided to ignore Bernie Sanders. They were hoping that by ignoring him, he wouldn't achieve what he has obviously achieved despite them. Imagine if they had grilled him on this on national TV, but they didn't even this was their solution. Their solution was to shut him out. You know, and now it's coming back to bite him in the proverbial butt. And if they had put him on the set, asked him those questions, and then seen how he was able to respond, where would we be today? So they, in a lot of ways, the worst thing they ever did was to ignore him. Because the kinds of things, the national media.
No. The people who ignored him and never brought it up were those other people up on the podium in the debates. They never brought it up. The whole thing was, oh, we can't fight amongst ourselves. We can't bring up that Amy Klobuchar has a horrible, horrible record in Minnesota and in Minneapolis, especially in terms of her relationship with the black community, with black shootings and police brutality. Nobody ever brought it up. Why? Because, we can't fight amongst ourselves and we want a woman for president.
Well,
I'm bringing it up right now because some of you people are still saying Amy Klobuchar is such a great candidate. Nobody has brought up the fact that when she goes to South Carolina, they're going to bring down people whose sons have been shot in cold blood by police in Minneapolis. And when that comes up, she collapses.
Ken?
Well, Stefan, I'm not sure why you're saying, no, the problem is the other Democrats on the stage should have called out the various candidates. Why do you exonerate the media?
Exactly.
Why shouldn't moderators or whatever they are who ask the questions, why shouldn't they be the ones that
are
challenging
stupid.
The candidates?
That's what bothers me, that they're not
stupid. They have
stupid.
No interest in it. The other contenders are the ones who have an interest in us knowing about the weaknesses of the other candidates.
Well, they have an interest. If capitalism works, then their media companies have an interest in the debates being worthwhile and people wanting to watch them. And if a media outlet has questioners who aren't asking the hard questions, then we'll all go look for a media where they do ask the hard questions.
Let me ask a question. Can you name me a candidate who I cannot find an incredible gotcha? Now the question – and remember how I've always – you've heard me say this before, Stefan. I wanted every candidate to file two forms when they announce, their personal financial statement and their personal failure statement, because every candidate is going to disappoint. And I'm not saying that because I don't want to know about what Amy did wrong. I don't want to know about what Mayor Pete did wrong. I don't want to know about what Bernie did wrong. I do. I absolutely do. And then I want to evaluate on the gestalt. What Donald Trump has done in some ways has elevated the idea of the cult. He has elevated the idea that we don't even care anymore because we have now so embraced Donald Trump that facts don't matter, murder doesn't matter, corruption doesn't matter, nothing matters because now the relationship is not a relationship between a citizen and a president. It is a relationship between you and a god. And you know what? They're not running for God. They are flawed human beings. And the idea of running a failure statement is to say, so let me explain to you, Amy Klobuchar says, about what happened in Minneapolis. Let me explain to you, Mayor Pete says, what happened in South Bend. Let me explain to you what Bernie Sanders needs to say about his relationship with some of the communists and socialists and everyone else around the world. Let me explain to you why I was there and why I supported them, but I won't embrace their form of leadership. I mean, this is part of the problem, and we're not going to get a perfect candidate, but what we haven't done is be able to flesh out what is the weakness and how do we still embrace the candidate because the strengths are greater than the weaknesses.
Well, I think you're right. And you know, somebody said to me, you know, why are all these people undecided? And I said, because in every presidential election that I've been a part of, and that's since 1970 when I came to Iowa State, most people have said, isn't there somebody better who could run for president in my party?
Of course.
People always look and say, isn't there someone better who could be running for president? And the answer is, yeah, there probably is, but they're not running. So this is what you got. You know, You pick one of the ones, and which one has the least, you know, terrible record or poor background. And with Bloomberg, what I'm hearing or reading and seeing is, yeah, he can take on Donald Trump better because he can throw massive amounts of money at him. He can have massive organization. He is a pretty tough Jewish guy from New York who's, you know, grown up in the Bronx or wherever, and he can do it, whereas the others, Donald Trump will crush them because Donald Trump, you know, is such a celebrity and is so rich, and Bloomberg can say, well, so am I, and I'm a lot richer than you are because I made a lot of money than you actually did. That's where we are as a country, and I think we're going to end up in November very disappointed in our choices.
Well, and so we're going to go into what happened in 2016. In 2016, Donald Trump had the highest negatives ever of any presidential candidate running. The person who had the second highest negatives of any candidate running was Hillary Clinton. And so what you saw were so many people either making the decision it was Tweedledum or Tweedledee, and they figured, let's go with the new guy because we don't like the old guy. Or you found people that decided not even to show up. And let me just say something about the not showing up. My greatest disappointment, you will hear me say this in every setting, is that I was told that in the Iowa caucus, it would be a huge turnout. It would eclipse 2008. The numbers would be great. The Democrats have all this passion and excitement. They hate Donald Trump. They're going to bring people out. You didn't. And so what scares me about that is that foretells what's going to happen in 2020 in November. The stories of Michigan's, the stories of Wisconsin's aren't about the people that flipped from Obama to Trump. It's about the people that didn't vote or the people that didn't even decide to pick a presidential candidate because they were so disgusted. This is the last thing we need is that to happen.
And as I said, if Oprah Winfrey was running in the Democratic Party for president, the turnout would be big.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I was going to tie together two of the things that Stefan was talking about. You said that other candidates should have called out the flaws and inconsistencies in their opponents, and why didn't they? And then you're also talking about voters wondering, well, why aren't there some better candidates available? I think the answer is the same. The candidates aren't going to highlight their opponents' flaws because they know they have plenty of flaws that they're going to get trashed with too.
That's why
better people don't run, because they're afraid to run because all of their flaws are going to get trashed across the media.
And on top of that, the other gatekeeper is notoriety and money. And that's the other thing. And how do you get notoriety? Well, you either acquire it or, you know, you've been in Congress forever and people at least have some name recognition. I mean, the sad thing about notoriety is Joe Biden had the notoriety but was not able to deliver a punch. And Bloomberg has the money. And guess what? He can buy the punch. So, you know, you end up saying, so in a democracy, what are our choices? You know, and I'm gonna go back to something that people are going to hate me for. I believe in term limits. I really do. I don't think that someone should be in Congress for 40 years. I don't think that's a celebration. I think that's a failure. I don't want people to be notorious because they've been there since they were 27 and they're 74 years old today. God help us. You know, that was not the point of this. And the reason why term limits may also be of value is that not only will we refresh the bench and encourage new people to run in, but you'll never have that kind of name recognition just because you've been there for 40 years. So at least that part will change.
And at least you wouldn't have, you know, people like Nancy Pelosi running around and tearing up speeches and stuff.
I mean, look, Nancy.
Or Mitch McConnell.
You know what? And we'll survive without a Nancy Pelosi, and we'll survive without a Mitch McConnell. They're not the only ones that can solve the problem. But right now, we assume that. That's wrong. I need to let you go, Stefan. I love you so much. Goodbye.
Bye.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. All right, everyone. We're going to end with what song as I have a heart attack here.
You are having a heart attack, and that's very disturbing, Arnie.
Well, I'm sorry. Stefan
so
does
this
song.
This song is for you. I thought it was for the rest of the country. It's called Pick Yourself Up and Start Over Again.
Here we go.
George Shearing and Nat King Cole.
And I need to do that. All right, everyone.
Pick yourself up. Take a deep breath, dust yourself off and start all over again.
nothing's impossible. I have found, for when my chin is on the ground, I pick myself up, dust myself off, and start all over again. Don't lose your confidence if you slip. Be grateful for a pleasant trip and pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and start all over again. Work like a soul inspired till the battle of the day is won. You may be sick and tired, but you'll be a man, my son. Will you remember the famous men who had to fall to rise again? So take a deep breath, pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and start all over again. Soul inspired till the battle of the day is won. You may be sick and tired, but you'll be a man, my son. Will you remember the famous men who had to fall to rise again? So take a deep breath.